Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general information about what to do when debt strikes you, what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's good to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. And we will continue on our journey out of the web of debt, which we have been studying for some weeks now and will continue in the future. I'd like to start with an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles in the area of debt. I highly recommend her principal book, The Web of Debt, and her website by that same name. And you can listen to all of the shows which have been produced related to the current topic at the archives under Life in Debt, www.kruufm.com, Life and Debt Archives. Just a quick recap on what we have been looking at, specifically the exploding myths about money and how our money system is not what we have been led to believe it is. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve, which may be a surprise to most people. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. And we've been looking at The Web of Debt, a book by Ellen Brown, which unravels this deception and really provides a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we have been heading. But it also offers and explores workable alternatives in dealing with this problem, and there is one in particular which was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. If you care about financial security, your own or your nation's, you should listen to this show and also go out and get the book, The Web of Debt. It's an important point to recognize, too, that one show in this series of shows builds upon prior shows, so it is useful to go back and listen to other shows or read the book. I will recap a little bit to start out with what I did in the last show, where I discussed money as credit to end the show. I was discussing the American colonies and their use of money. Essentially, the desolate wilderness of the colonies was transformed into fruitful abundance using a medium of exchange that economist David Hume called representative money and Benjamin Franklin called bills of credit, the paper currency of local colonial governments. This is not the way it had been done in England, and as we will see, it really infuriated England at that time. The distinction of being the first local government to issue its own paper money went to the province of Massachusetts. The year was 1691, 3 years before the charter of the Bank of England. Jason Goodwin, who tells the story in his 2003 book, Greenback, writes that Massachusetts buccaneer governor had led a daring assault on Quebec in an attempt to drive the French out of Canada. But the assault had failed. Militiamen and widows needed to be paid. The local merchants were approached but declined, saying they had other demands on their money. The very idea of paper currency had been suggested in 1650 in an anonymous British pamphlet titled The Key to Wealth, or A New Way for Improving of Trade, Lawful, Easy, Safe, and Effectual. That was the title. The paper currency proposed by the pamphleteer was modeled on the receipts issued by London goldsmiths and silversmiths for the precious metals left in their vaults for safekeeping. And I've discussed this at length in the past, how the banking system developed from the goldsmith safekeeping system. In short, people deposited their gold and silver with the goldsmiths, who kept it in a very safe place. And the goldsmiths discovered that only about 20% of that gold was ever in demand by those who deposited it. When it was deposited, receipts were given for the gold, but at any one time, only 20% of those receipts were being returned. So the goldsmiths did the quite immoral thing. They started issuing receipts called loans to the tune at least 5 times as much as the actual gold or silver that they possessed, a concept that we may now call leveraging. But in essence, what they were doing was lending money that was not theirs. And that money was just in the form of a paper receipt. And it was for many, many times what they could even back if everyone returned their receipts at the same time. Now, coming back to the colonies, the problem for the colonies was that they were short of silver and gold. They had to use foreign coins to conduct trade. And since they imported more than they exported, the coins were continually being drained off to England and other countries, leaving the colonists without enough money for their own internal needs. The Massachusetts Assembly proposed a new kind of paper money, which they called a bill of credit, representing the government's bond, or IOU. It's promised to pay tomorrow on a debt incurred today. The paper money of Massachusetts was backed only by, and this is important, the full faith and credit of the government. Other colonies followed this lead from Massachusetts with their own issues of paper money. Some were considered government IOUs, redeemable later in hard currency, which would have been the gold or silver. But some were actually made as legal tender in themselves. And what's legal tender? Legal tender is money that must legally be accepted in the payment of debts. It is as good as gold in trade without bearing debt or an obligation to redeem the notes in some other form of money later. And that worked for a while in the colonies. But then some lack of confidence in the new paper money occurred, and a famous minister, Cotton Mather, came to the defense of the money. He argued, is a bond or a bill of exchange for £1,000 other than paper? And yet it is not as valuable as so much silver or gold, supposing the security of payment is sufficient. Now, what is the security of your paper money less the credit of the whole country? That's the full faith and credit of the government, is what he was describing there. And in short, what Mather had done was redefine money. What it represented was not a sum of gold or silver, it was credit, the credit of the whole country. And that's a profound and very, very critical point in the understanding of how our money system both developed and how it has taken a massive detour from the analysis which is best suited for the vast majority of people in this country, and later on we'll see actually the world. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's get back to the colonies. It was known that Benjamin Franklin was such an enthusiast for the new medium of exchange that he actually has been called the father of paper money. Unlike Cotton Mather, who went to Harvard at the age of 12, Franklin, as most of us know, was self-taught, which, as an aside, shows you don't have to go to Harvard or even college necessarily to be extraordinarily successful in life. Benjamin Franklin learned his trade on the job, and his trade happened to be, what? Printing. In 1729, he wrote and printed a pamphlet called A Modest Enquiry into the Nature and Necessity of Paper Currency. That was the title. It was circulated throughout the colonies and became very popular, earning him contracts to print paper money for New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware. Benjamin Franklin wrote his pamphlet after observing the remarkable effects paper currency had had in stimulating the economy in his own province of Pennsylvania. He said, quote, "Experience, more prevalent than all the logic in the world, has fully convinced us all that paper money has been and is now of the greatest advantage to the country." End quote. Paper currency secured against future tax revenues, he said, turn prosperity tomorrow into ready money today. The government did not need gold to issue this currency, and it did not need to go into debt to the banks. In America, the land of opportunity, this ready money would allow even the poor to get ahead. Franklin also wrote that, quote, "Many that understand business very well, but have not a stock sufficient of their own, will be encouraged to borrow money to trade with when they have had it at a modest interest." And he also said what is probably the most practical and critical point in the normal person's understanding of what money is supposed to be, but as we will see, does not represent. He said, "The riches of a country are to be valued by the quantity of labor its inhabitants are able to purchase, and not by the quantity of gold and silver they possess." When gold was the medium of exchange, money determined production rather than production determining the money supply. And that's critical. When gold was plentiful, things got produced. When it was scarce, men were out of work and people knew want. The virtue of government-issued paper scrip was that it could grow along with productivity, allowing potential wealth to become real wealth. The government could pay for services with paper receipts that were basically community credits. In this way, the community actually created supply and demand at the very same time. The farmer would not farm, the teacher would not teach, the miner would not mine unless the funds were available to compensate them for their labors. Paper scrip underwrote the production of goods and services that would not otherwise have been on the market. Anything for which there was a buyer and a producer could be produced and traded. If A had what B wanted, B had what C wanted, and C had what A wanted, they could all get together and trade. They did not need the moneylender's gold, which could be hoarded, manipulated, or lent only at usurious interest rates. Now, this is so far afield from where we are in our economy today, and we'll get deeper into this. But going back to where it all began in the United States, at that time the colonies, the new paper money did more than make the colonies independent of the British bankers and their gold. It actually allowed the colonists to finance their local governments without taxing the people. To us today, this seems like some miraculous or mythical concept. Alvin Rubushka, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, traces this development in a 2002 article called Representation Without Taxation. He writes that there are two main ways that the colonies issued paper money. Most colonies used both in varying proportions. One was a direct issue of notes, usually called bills of credit or treasury notes. These were IOUs of the government backed by specific future taxes. But the payback was deferred well into the future, and sometimes the funds never got to the treasury at all. It's kind of like a bathtub without a drain. The money supply kept increasing without a means of recycling it back to its source. These funds were at least not owed back to private foreign lenders, and no interest was due on them. They were just credits issued and spent into the economy on goods and services. This recycling problem, though, was solved when a second method of issue was devised. Colonial assemblies discovered that provincial loan offices could generate a steady stream of revenue in the form of interest by taking on the lending functions of a bank. A government loan office called a land bank would issue paper money and lend it to residents, usually farmers, at low rates of interest. The loans were secured by mortgages on the real property, silver plate, and other hard assets. Benjamin Franklin wrote, "Bills issued upon land are in effect coined land." New money issued and lent to borrowers came back to the loan office on a regular payment schedule, preventing the money supply from overinflating and keeping the values of paper loan office bills stable in terms of English sterling. Now here's an important principle. The interest paid on the loans also went into public coffers funding the government. Colonies relying on this method of issuing paper money thus wound up with more stable currencies than those relying heavily on new issues of bills of credit. The most successful loan offices were in the middle colonies, Pennsylvania, Delaware, New York, and New Jersey. The model that earned the admiration of all was the loan office established in Pennsylvania in 1723. The Pennsylvania plan showed that it was quite possible for the government to issue new money in place of taxes without inflating prices. From 1723 until the French and Indian Wars in the 1750s, the provincial government collected no taxes at all. The loan office was the province's chief source of revenue, supplemented by import duties on liquor. During this period, Pennsylvania wholesale prices remained stable. The currency depreciated by 21% against English sterling, but it was shown that this was due to external trade relations rather than to changes in the quantity of currency in circulation. This is showing a very successful way to avoid taxes, and I'll return after this station break. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's continue about the loan office. Before the loan office came to the rescue, Pennsylvania had been losing both business and residents due to a lack of available currency. The loan office injected new money into the economy, and it allowed people who had been forced to borrow from private lenders at 8% interest to refinance their debts at the 5% rate offered by the provincial government. Franklin said that this money system was the reason that Pennsylvania had so greatly increased its inhabitants, having replaced the inconvenient method of barter and given new life to business and promoted greatly the settlement of new lands by lending small sums to beginners on easy interest. And the secret of making this work was not to issue too much and to recycle the money back to the government in the form of principal and interest on government-issued loans. In 1776, Adam Smith wrote of the Pennsylvania currency in the wealth of nations. He said, the government of Pennsylvania, without amassing any treasure, which was gold or silver, invented a method of lending, not money, indeed, but what is equivalent to money to its subjects, by advancing to private people at interest and upon land security as collateral, paper bills of credit made transferable from hand to hand like banknotes, and declared by act of assembly to be legal tender in all payments from one inhabitant to another, it raised a moderate revenue which went a considerable way toward defraying the whole ordinary expense of that frugal and orderly government. And he finishes by saying, Pennsylvania's paper currency is said never to have sunk below the value of gold and silver, which was current in the colony before the issue of paper money. So we saw that the Pennsylvania currency was very, very stable. However, that was not true of paper currencies of other New England colonies. Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and New Hampshire were less stable, although they helped to finance development and growth that would not otherwise have occurred. They did not maintain their value because they were issued in excessive quantities, both as bills of credit and as loans. The currencies also suffered from a lack of common regulations and standards for valuation. Some paid interest, others did not. Some could be used only for purchase and not in the repayment of debt. Some could be used for public debts, but not for private transactions. Well, the bottom line was the result for trade was chaos and confusion in those colonies. Then, of course, King George stepped in, with rapid depreciation of the New England bills, eventually threatening the investments of the British merchants and financiers who were doing business with the colonies. They leaned on Parliament to prohibit the practice. So, in 1751, King George II enacted a ban on the issue of new paper money in the New England colonies. Existing issues could still be renewed. This ban was continued under King George III, who succeeded his father in 1760. Well, in 1764, Benjamin Franklin went to London to petition Parliament to lift the ban. He extolled the benefits of colonial scrip to the citizens of Pennsylvania and assured his listeners that New York and New Jersey have also increased greatly during the same period with the use of paper money, so that it does not appear to be of the ruinous nature ascribed to it. The scholar Jason Goodwin observed in Greenback, his book, that it was a tricky argument to make. The colonists had been stressing to the mother country how poor they were, so poor they were forced to print paper money for lack of precious metals. But Franklin comes along, and his report demonstrates to the Parliament and the British bankers that the pretext for allowing paper money had been removed. The point of having colonies was not, after all, to bolster the colonies' economies. It was to provide raw materials at decent rates to the mother country. Giving the government the benefit of money creation was a complete reversal of the established British school of economics, in which the government had to borrow from private bankers at interest. And Franklin's appeal was viciously opposed by banking interests. Instead of lifting the ban, Parliament wound up passing a currency act that was stricter than the earlier prohibition. It banned not only the issue of any new bills, but the reissue of existing currency. The bill declared that no act, order, resolution, or vote of the Assembly in any of His Majesty's colonies or plantations in America shall be made for creating or issuing any paper bills or bills of credit of any kind or denomination whatsoever, declaring such paper bills or bills of credit to be legal tender. With this, the colonists were forced to pay all future taxes to Britain in silver or gold, or in Bank of England banknotes, supposedly backed by those precious metals. Since the colonists had no mines of their own, that meant they had to go into debt to the British bankers. Alexander Hamilton, the first U.S. Treasury Secretary, said that paper money had composed 3/4 of the total money supply before the American Revolution. When the colonists could not issue their own currency, the money supply suddenly shrank, leaving widespread unemployment, hunger, and poverty in its wake. The consequence is typical. The oppressed colonists finally ignored the ban and went back to issuing their own paper money. In the book, The Lost Science of Money, Stephen Zarlenga quotes historian Alexander Del Mar, who wrote in 1895, quote, "The creation and circulation of bills of credit by revolutionary assemblies, coming as they did upon the heels of the strenuous efforts made by the Crown to suppress paper money in America, were acts of defiance so contemptuous and insulting to the Crown that forgiveness was therefore impossible. There was but one course for the Crown to pursue, and that was to suppress and punish these acts of rebellion. Thus, the bills of credit of this era, which ignorance and prejudice have attempted to belittle into the mere instruments of a reckless financial policy, were really the standards of the revolution. They were more than this. They were the revolution itself." End quote. This is a very different version of the American Revolution than we get in school. And this version of events leading up to the revolution was echoed by Peter Cooper, founder of Cooper Union College, and a former colleague of Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin. Cooper wrote in his 1883 book, Ideas for a Science of Good Government, quote, "After Franklin had explained to the British government as to the real cause of prosperity, they immediately passed laws forbidding the payment of taxes in that money. This produced such great inconvenience and misery to the people that it was the principal cause of the revolution. A far greater reason for a general uprising than the Tea and Stamp Act was the taking away of the paper money." And this view was also confirmed by historian Charles Bullock, who was a particularly credible source because he was not actually in favor of paper money. He advocated a return to specie, which is precious metal coinage. Bullock wrote in the year 1900, "There can be little doubt that the acts of 1751 and 1764, which suppressed further issues of bills of credit, contributed not a little to the final breach with the mother country." In 1776, when he was examined before the House of Commons, Franklin gave it as his deliberate opinion that one reason for the impatience and disrespect which the colonies were manifesting toward parliamentary authority was the prohibition of making paper money. Too little attention has been given to this fact by most historians. In colony after colony, party lines came to be drawn upon this sole issue. So this really is the cornerstone of the revolution. Like Massachusetts nearly a century earlier, the colonists suddenly found themselves at war and without the means to pay for it. The first act of the new Continental Congress was to issue its own paper scrip, popularly called the Continental. Most of the Continentals were issued as IOUs or debts of the revolutionary government, to be redeemed in coinage later. By the end of the war, the scrip had been devalued so much that it was essentially worthless, but it still evoked the wonder and admiration of foreign observers because it allowed the colonists to do something that had never been done before. They succeeded in financing a war against a major power with virtually no hard currency of their own, and they did it without taxing the people. Franklin wrote from England during the war that the whole is a mystery even to the politicians, how we could pay with paper that had no previously fixed fund appropriated specifically to redeem it. This currency, as we manage it, is a wonderful machine, and Thomas Paine called it the cornerstone of the revolution. And I'll continue next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.